Okay, I am on. My name is Roya P. I use her, she pronouns. I am originally from New York City. I'm a Queens gal that was transplanted in Pasadena to do my PhD studies and then traveled to Seattle to do a job for Fuller, and now I'm unemployed if anybody wants to hire me. COVID layoff. Anyway, as an artist, I always had these experiences in culture, whether it's reading a book or watching a movie or looking at art or making art, that were revelatory or illuminating or healing. So much so that when I became a Christian in my college years after I met Brian, I was trying to make those sense of those experiences in relation to the Christian disciplines that I was being taught in the church. And I was wondering why these two worlds never kind of met. And that's what drove me to go back to seminary, get another graduate degree in theological studies, to eventually get a PhD. And I'm still asking those questions. How do these two things make sense? Okay, so that's kind of like where I'm coming from. The title to this little lesson is called The Secular Liturgies of Social Practice Art, Artists' Disquieting Invitation of the Real. This little fragment, Disquieting Invitations of the Real, is from the Cuban-American Catholic theologian Cecilia Gonzalez Adru. This presentation was actually created in response to one of her essays. She writes, "Grace is the recognition of beauty possible when we reach out to face the real in all its woundedness, wounded fullness, and engage its truths." So I'm going to just, perhaps this is an example of that. This is a video.
It's trying to come in contact with people or confront their boundaries or confront a stigma. Homelessness is something to stigmatize because it's a vulnerable position and people tend to fear what makes them vulnerable. Transition is a hair salon on wheels. It's inside a little ice cream truck. It's been refurbished into a functioning salon. And what we do is we visit homeless shelters in Brooklyn and Manhattan and provide free services to people living in the shelter. A hair salon is a place to get a really practical need met, but it's also a social space and it's a place to feel cared for. Yeah. That's going to reach in and bring out other parts of identity that have been pushed aside and forgotten about and recede in the daily struggle for survival.
Me atrevía a venirme y me vine en tren, cruzando todo México con un tren. Muy triste, porque hay muchos que mueren en su intento. Y pues yo tuve la dicha de llegar. Y ahora quiero luchar por lo que siempre quería hacer.
It has nothing to do with do with makeovers. It's more about their self-esteem, and I think that's the most important part. It's, yes, you're looking at yourself in the mirror, but that's the beginning of it. The rest of it is how you feel all the time, and I think that's what we're really trying to instill in them here. I got picked out at 16. It teaches me to be humble, one, and two, it kind of gives them an outlook as far as like there's more to life. Like, yes, we get knocked down sometimes, but it's about being picked up and finding our own strength and our own growth in it. So that's what really made me decide to be a part of this whole project.
My assistant, Tanisha, and I asked stylists to come on board, and we got 80% rejection. But then the people who ended up doing it, they were immediate yeses. They were like, yes, I've always wanted to do something like this. I've thought about it before, and this was an opportunity that we needed to make it happen. One of the goals of the project was to really just meet an individual's needs and to give each person exactly what they asked for.
I don't wear with that curl.
Say that again?
I don't wear with the curl, we are straight.
What, you want a pin straight instead, you mean? Okay. Yeah. Hey, what's it like, Amanda? You tell me and I will change it for you. I don't mind at all.
Maybe they were a little happier with how they looked physically, but I think the other half of that story is just that the stylist is making them feel good and not judging them.
What do you think? Pretty good? Good?
You're
good.
Thank you.
You're welcome. No problem at all. Have a good day.
You too, Douglas.
Part of the magic of the experience was just the fact that this service was really unexpected. It wasn't part of a regimented routine. I mean, it was almost like a portal, like you would walk into the back of the truck and you'd be in this salon. So I think it was used to transport people outside of their everyday experience. So that was what was interesting to me about it. Even though it was happening on a micro level, a very small scale, you know, it meant a lot to people who were part of that. I hope that this project can start to break down those stigmas that keep people who are homeless isolated.
Feeling loved, able to carry on and transform, we are gifted with courage to do difficult things, writes Cecilia Gonzalez Calderon. Mm-hmm. So that was one example of a social practice artwork. I'm going to backtrack a little bit to do a little bit of history. So in the 1990s, the curator and critic Nicholas Bourriard noticed artists that were doing interesting things that opened up aspects of life that had been kept apart. And indeed, Cecilia Gonzalez and Drew writes, what is beautiful unites, and the pain of the world is most apparent in the incessant efforts to divide humans against humans. So we have Felix Gonzalez Torres's candy pile, we have Rick Taranich, creating dinners in the gallery, and we have Carlston Holston, the three artists that he, and many artists that he talks about. So I'm going to quickly go through what they did. And we talked about this at Brian's talk. Felix Gonzalez Torres created candy piles or candy carpets. And what this does is that it shifts the art object and the artist, art viewer who comes into the art space, and that art viewer now becomes art participant as they grab a candy because it's a free gift of grace to mm-hmm. them, and they put it in their mouth and they sensibly take in the art. And so now the artist space is now not this disassociative, detached space, but now becomes activated through the viewer becoming participant. And it also makes the gallery or the art organization, whether it's a gallery or museum, to now be committed to replenish the stock, to continually give away. And so here the artist is taking away that coldness of the art space and activating it into a space of grace. The next artist is Ritprit Taravinich. And he would go into the gallery and cook this supper. So this happens to be pad thai. And so he activates the gallery, not into a space that shows art objects, but into a social space. The art object becomes the archaeological remnants of that social of those social transactions. And so he's kind of going, crossing the private-public lines that we tend to live in, what's public, what's private. He's crossing, you know, the lines of, here it goes, he's exposing the way that we look at art. He's allowing the visitor to become participant again and become part of the experiment and now part of the art itself. And then Kostin Holler actually tries to cross the divides that actual borders or actual walls create. And so here's one piece where he installs slides in buildings. When we saw it, Brian and I, this was in the new museum, and I think that building is about 6 stories high. So you go on at story 6, and you go all the way down to story, and you have to sign a disclaimer form. One of the other pieces that Brian actually did was at the PS1, where on one of the top floors, you lie on a board on your back, and they slide you out a window. A what?
Head first
out a window so you can see the sky. Again, kind of trying to open up the spaces between inner and outer, up and down, and trying to kind of, in a way, and as an analogy, of trying to break down the walls that keep things apart in a very symbolic way. So those are the predecessors of this these social experiments in space and place. And so not only are they social person to person making viewer participant, but they're also kind of designating what space can do and what place can do and making us attentive to our surroundings. So I happen, as a theologian, I look at this and I happen to think of these as liturgies, secular liturgies. The Greek word liturgia is actually means services performed for the benefits of people. So prior to Christians picking up the word liturgy for our church worship services, the Roman Greco world had liturgies where a patron would do a good civil duty on behalf of the patron of the city. And so we even see that today. So when you're driving down the highway and there's a sign that says this patch of the highway is brought to you by Kiwanis Club. That's a liturgy. That's a liturgy. And so these artists are performing liturgies, but I happen to think that they're very spiritual, because as you could see with Jody Wood's Beauty in Transition, they're actually giving life and nourishing people. So I'm going to show you a couple more examples of social practice artworks to get across what I'm talking about. And as I do, what the heck? If you can close that door, that top door, I appreciate it. That door. I'll get to that idea. Too many ideas. So as we're looking at these artworks, I want you to note how art feeds resilience, how art breeds resistance, how it seeks transformation, and it unifies.
God bless you.
So let me read this quote. Incarceration, you don't have problems. Incarceration, you don't have life. So that is what freedom is. Freedom is to have problems and enjoy those problems. This is a quote from a reentry think tank fellows. So People's Reentry Think Tank is a social practice art piece created by Courtney Bowles and Mark Strandquist. They basically created and facilitate a fellows for the formerly incarcerated. I skipped over a lot of things here. Okay, so they initiated and run a fellows program comprised of the formerly incarcerated, nominated by various reentry organizations. The fellows gather weekly to brainstorm ways to abolish stereotypes, change the way social services are done. They perform advocacy primarily through the arts, so you can see their work that transforms spaces in prisons, legal aid clinics, different kinds of bureaucratic offices, including City Hall and museums. People's Reentry Think Tank also is dependent and builds upon People's Paper Co-op. And so Courtney and Mark kind of do these paper projects. And the one that I love that an assignment that they do with their fellows is where the fellows take their actual records, criminal records, rip them up, put them in the blender, and create paper out of it. And then they're asked to rethink about their life and where they want to go and produce that on the reconstituted papers of their criminal records. And you know, as a theologian, this is the penal substitutionary theory where Christ takes our records of wrongs and gives us his record, clean record. And they're physically going through that transaction by the paper making method. Beautiful, right? Okay, so this is I can spend an hour here. The Esther Gates is my subject for my dissertation. I'm a theologian, I do constructive theology. I construct a theology of hospitality by analyzing the artworks of Theaster Gates. And the Dorchester Project is his most well-known project, and this is where he takes abandoned lots and buildings in his neighborhood on the south side of Chicago, neighborhood of Greater Grand Crossings, and he renovates them to make cultural venues for his neighbors. So these are his first buildings that he bought. So this was the first iteration of Black Cinema House. This is how it was before. This is how it is now. It's a nice, beautiful corner. Right now, it's his home, living abode. But before, the Black Cinema House was where they would show on Friday nights films from the Black Diaspora. Every Friday night, they had a calendar. And they also had lessons on how to, you know, video. Lessons for the, it's around the corner, there's an element, junior high. So those junior high kids would take lessons on how to create videos in the Black Cinema House. This is the Archive House and the Listening House. So Theaster Gates is a collector of things. He loves material reality. So here, the closeout of record stores is here in the Listening House, so you can go there, and if you have a proposal, you need to listen to albums, you go in there and you go put a record on a turntable. The Archives House has books that he also collected from closed shops. He also houses the glass slides for the art history department for the University of Chicago. But the Archives House is also the location for a series of dinner performances that he gave called Soul Food Pavilion. And so I have a whole chapter on this where he invites at his table which is beautifully set. He's a potter, so you're eating off of his plates. There's wine. He has a music ensemble called the Black Monks of Mississippi. So he has a dinner ritual with a liturgy of music, poetry, a sermon, as you will. He has a lesson on soul food and the history of soul food, and venture capitalists are sitting next to his neighbors. Artists are sitting next to carpenters and construction workers. Aunties are sitting next to architects. It is a mixed bag sitting at this table. And then after they get to know one another through their stories and through the wine and through the music, he says, okay, now we're going to talk about things that you don't talk about at the table. We're going to talk about God. We're going to talk about money. We're going to talk about power. We're going to talk about, you know, injustice. And you have to do it because you're my guest. but you can see how dinner now paves the way for these ethical discussions. The rituals of the table. In my dissertation, I kind of argue how Gates' table helps us to re-see or re-crack open Christ's table and his radical hospitality. Especially when you're reading through Luke, all the meals when you're reading through Luke are revolutionary. After you think about what Gates is doing here. Okay. So one of the projects that are in the Dorchester project is actually taking city housing and making it into mixed income housing. He took four of these units at the heart of the complex and he made it into an artist studio with the kind of flooring that's possible for dancers. And so, you know, so if you move into one of these units, you know, you get a washer and dryer and you also get free workshops at the art center. But it's also a way of the residents actually hosting workshops, yoga, you know, workshops for the junior hires down the street. So it's a different form of hospitality where now, because you live here, you're offering this kind of aesthetic hospitality to surrounding neighbors. And the largest building is the Stony Island Savings Bank that he bought from the city for $1. But the problem was the city only gave him 30 days to make it structurally sound so he could start doing the renovations. So the way that he raised money to do that was he took in the bathrooms, in the urinals, he took the marble walls and he cut them into blocks, and those were art bonds, and it said an art we trust, and he sold them in the art market. And that's how he raised the money. By the way, he calls this an ecological, how does he do it? Sorry, I'm thinking. He calls this an ecology place or something like that, where a circular ecology where he takes out the stuff from the buildings that he's renovating, and then he makes art objects, you know, like he makes these installations or he makes art objects. He sells them art in the art world. That money comes back into Rebuild Foundation is his nonprofit for this, for the Dorchester Project. So he calls that a circular ecology, where his work as an artist feeds the neighborhood and creating avenues for his neighbors. His neighbors don't have to leave the south side of Chicago. They don't have to leave Grand Crossings to listen to good music. They just walk down the street. They don't have to leave their block in order to do yoga lessons or art lessons. I can go on and on. This is also the repository of, he is the steward of the Johnson & Johnson publications, Ebony and, you know, Ebony and Essence, Jet, all their research books, he's stewarding them. He's taking care of them. He has them all there. So it is also a bank repository for Black culture. And he's doing that all under the gut as an art installation, performance piece. Okay. Again, I can go on and on. So, Sol Adamendi. This is in Queens, yay. Sol went to Queens College where I got my MFA, and as part of her MFA project, she started working with the jornalero population, which is the day workers who are typically illegal immigrants, and you know, they're the guys and the women who are at the Home Depot looking for day laborers. And so she started working with that population, teaching them photography. And as she began to get to know them and their stories, she realized that wage theft is a huge problem in that population. And so she began to join forces with other organizations and to figure out how could we deal. That's a big concern as artists. How could we help? And so she developed an app where everyone in the jornalero population had the app. If someone underpaid them, if someone didn't give them enough, you know, they couldn't get breaks. If somebody was doing any wrongdoing, they could, the person could put in all the information, the license plate number of the person looking, you know, who's trying to get work from the, you know. So basically, it was an alarm system for that population to know not to take work from that person. Apps for Power, she calls it. So she writes, she says, sorry, part of my work as an artist, cites Adamende, is to do cross-pollination between different organizations and disciplines. So part advocacy, part empowerment, part community building project, Adamende offers a measure of agency to immigrants who normally have to look down and just keep on working. De tu puña y letra, diálogos en el ruedo. This is a project by Susan Lacey. Susan Lacey has been working in this kind of large-scale participatory projects or performances that usually revolve around social political issues, and she's been doing this forever. And so, in this one, is actually working off of an original project called Letras de Mujeres. Letras de Mujeres was a series of workshops and letter writing campaign that collected 32,000 testimonials from women who recounted their experiences of violence. And these were then letters that were later submitted to the UN. But not much happened. And so frustrated by the lack of policy change, another series of workshops were later installed, and this time for men. Here, Lacey asked, or proposed, the questions that she had asked to do this was, what if men were to read the letters? What if each one became a part of that letter? What if they were to read their letter out loud in a public arena, thus putting their bodies on the line? So the workshops were key to inciting male empathy and responsibility. Pretty powerful, huh? Okay, so the Tupunya letra. So she, for the Tupunya letra, Lacey worked with universities, the government, NGOs, activists, and artists in Quito, Ecuador. All this happened in Ecuador. And so for the final performance, men read the letters out loud. This was not only a moving transaction, but symbolically represented the way men could participate towards policy change on the behalf of women. Or perhaps we can think of this performance as a way that primes the needed actions of males to eradicate violence against women. Lacey's secular rituals provide a way to navigate unjust wounds through very embodied means. It's a testament, I think, to what we can learn as Christians on how to navigate painful situations as Cecilia Gonzalez, the Jew, is the grace at looking at the truth and looking at the wounds. So, indeed, so where's my time?
Oh, I had a quick question.
Yes.
Can you tell me what the title means?
Oh, sure. From your hand, you know, from your handwriting. It's basically a Spanish equivalent. From your own hand. dialogues in the circle, in the, you know, a round circle dialogue. So first the women came with their letter writing, and then the male response. So your art is navigating that divide. So I actually wrote this because I was speaking to pastors and seminarians. So just imagine you all seminarians, okay? Pastors, future pastors, students of theology and culture, or theology and art, should pay heed to these artists who model in unusual ways the cruciform life. Where sorrows, as poet Lucille Clifton pens, are winged and beautiful. Sorrows, she writes, attach themselves as scars attach the skin. What Clifton is alluding to is the physical impact of grief and of woundedness, heaviness that must be actually mediated through poetic means so that we can get to felt grace. Indeed, the theologian Cecilia Gonzalez-Andrew reminds us that grace is not a concept, but an experience that is recognized in the midst of a suffering world. And for this reason, I actually turned to theologian Samuel Sullivan, who talks about orthopathos. Okay, so I was trained I lived for a very long time in a reform circle and had a job doing vocational ministries, and so it was drummed into me that orthodoxy leads to orthopraxis. Mm-hmm. And Sullivan's saying we need orthopathos because the heart needs to drive that. It bridges that. We're not going to do we could have the right thought, we could have the right theology, and we can do the right practice, but really it has to be the heart that is beating and the bridge between those two things, orthopathos. And that's why we need the art, because the arts allow us to not know about the problem, but to enter into it. Anyway, so, amen? Mm-hmm. Orthopathos links orthodoxy to orthopraxis by maximizing emotional and empathetic acumen to direct all of life's experiences to God. Like these artists, we need those who minister through the poetic that permits this orthopathos attention to human wounds as entry points for grace to erupt in unexpected beauty, as Gonzalez-Andrew writes. So one of the markers of grace is joy, right? And when it comes to the question of how Christians can cultivate the orthopathos of joy, I love referring to Willie Jennings, the theologian Willie Jennings. He says that, you know, he advocates for, in order to learn what joy really is that we need to follow those who, quote, learn to ride the winds of chaos. And he suggests that we actually go into African American communities who've created a geography of joy to acquire their infectious creativity. Jennings states that amid the oppressions, microaggressions, joy becomes a state and a way of life that continually resists all the forces of despair and dehumanization. He further relates that barbershops and beauty parlors, like we saw in the beginning, they are the places where the currency of joy is exchanged, right? So he calls them spaces of profound realities of indirection. Profound realities of indirection that exchanges that joy. And so that's his appeal, is to find those places and to create those spaces, right? And that's mine. I think that's what these artists are doing. So then my question that I have written here is, to the Christian community is then, what can we offer? Can we offer these spaces? Can we engender spaces where, as poet Ross Gay puts it, we can join our wildernesses together? The gallery over here has a show based off of Ross Gay's article, I think it was in The Atlantic, where he's talking about woundedness, where wounds, touching wounds, finds the spirit of life. And so that's his suggestion, is we have to open ourselves to our wounds and share them. And so we share our wildernesses.
Where is that exhibit?
It's right here, Shallow One.
It's the bottom of
Chandelier 2. Yes.
The bottom floor.
Yeah. Yeah, basically we just, truth, brokenness, wounds, that's where we start to be, to bridging. So I suggest, to this end, I suggest we follow the lead of artists. who are willing to go into suffering and who understand that suffering and grace are actually bounded together, and they actually call us to engage and wear the truth like scars that stretch across skin. So yeah, that's it. That's all I have, folks. Now it's Q&A. Comments, questions, or observations? Yes?
Can you repeat your question to the Christian community?
What kind of spaces could we make where we can allow for that kind of vulnerability?
I have a thought about that. Mm-hmm. It strikes me how what a disservice, how dangerous it is that in many Christian contexts, certainly not all, there is a cultural norm of appearing happy or appearing as though things are going well in my life, or even saying everything's going well, because that's supposed to be a noble thing to do, even if you're suffering. It's almost like hide the wounds is a cultural norm in a lot of Christian contexts. Mm-hmm. And given what you've just said about the linking of wounded, the profound beauty and joy that are rendered by shared woundedness, I just want to say I really appreciate that question. I think it's a key and unlocking question. And I know one person who I really respect who's involved in community organizing and the development of ministry, and she turned that way out of her experience of a church in which it was the norm to share woundedness. Mm. And I have no other necessary ideas about doing that right now, other than that it seems like the Christian and Jewish traditions have some incredible resources historically.
Definitely.
Just for instance, in the Psalms of Lament.
Sure. Just the table. Think about the table. Think about, I write about in 1 Corinthians, certain people read that text and they think it's like getting your ducks all in the line theologically so that you can come to the table finally. Uh-huh. But Paul's angry that the rich are eating ahead of the poor. This table is the equalizing, it's profound, because in the social Greco world, the table was a way of actually eking out where you are in the social ladder. You only ate at the table with your social, your alike, so that you that's where you ate. And so now women are at this table, Greek, Jew, Roman. That is like, we read that and we don't understand like how freaking radical that is. We don't, and that Paul is angry because these rich Christians are now breaking with this witness. The table is a witness, a visual, and I think all these artists, what they're doing is their performance are visual witnesses of what grace really looks and feels like.
Wow, and that's what's his name? Theaster Gates?
Yes.
Yeah.
The table he set up was intentionally non-hierarchical.
Right.
And mixing people.
Right. Yeah. Correct.
Well,
Yeah. And our pastor started saying, you know, at the table was the one who would betray me, the one who would deny me, yeah. And they're all at the same table.
They're all sitting on one side of the table. That's a little bit, you know. In Leonardo's, just, you know.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of artists picking up on this table, radical hospitality. I mean, there are a lot of artists who are doing food. And food is actually what you serve. Okay, basically, food, who gets to distribute it? Who gets to be at the table? You know, all these social political things are magnified at the table, if you let it, you know, for... as Christians, it's like, you know, depending on your denomination, there's a fence or not. Yeah. Who gets to serve it or not? Who's invited? You know, when is, you know, so there's a lot there to unpack the table. So artists are actually doing that already. One of the things that I argue in my dissertation is the Oscar Gates is a product of the Black Church. And he will say that. He's, you know, he would, if you go to Art 21, this video, and he's like, the Black Church allowed me to have the imagination of what can be. He probably would state that he's not a practicing Christian now, but what he's doing there is he's taking the rhythms, the liturgical rhythms, the rituals of his upbringing, and he's applying them in the public sphere to show how powerful these things are. And my argument is that just like he has a circular ecology, there's a liturgical circular thing going on that if we look at the Astor Gates and then apply what he's doing, the circle comes full. Mm-hmm. We now, you know, the product of the church out in the street, we look what he's doing as Christians and we reapply it and reactivate our own traditions. And so that's my argument. He's not doing anything different. He's just applying it so that for all people to benefit from what we've had in our traditions forever, and reactivating it and showing us the power that we already have, and engaging in these things. And you could see it, you know, with Jody Wood. I don't know if she's, I'm wondering if she comes from a Christian background or not. When you hear her talk in other things, but her next project that I think kind of shut down because of COVID was she started collecting, if you want to do a social practice art work or you want to do some social good, she has a website with all these zip codes that the closest zip code that you're close to, if you click on it, there's all these organizations, including churches, that need volunteers. That's her next social practice artwork.
Yeah. Quite.
Yeah.
So as I'm listening to you talk about circular ecologies and gateways and to see behind, I can't help but think of the work you're currently doing in the studio right now.
Okay.
which everyone, if they can go take a peek and check out. But I'm wondering how you see those things kind of showing up in your own work. And do you see your work in some way contributing to this lineage? I mean, I do. I just wanted to see what you thought.
It's harder for me to have to be critical about my own work.
Don't be critical.
No, but like, but doing that reflexive action of reflecting on why am I doing what I'm doing? It is a good question, and I think I like the Astor Gates because the Astor Gates doing these social practice artworks, but he also feels like he's also from the modern, in modern art, or the modern way of making art is to make art objects, and he loves making art objects. And so I'm still from that idea of you make art objects, so I do make art objects, but I can't help but it does come out in my artwork, all these things that I'm thinking about. So I started making paintings that are made out of paper, because it's easier, I'm doing dissertation, I got jobs, blah, blah, blah. And so they start becoming assemblages where I'm taking the paper and they're becoming three-dimensional. And they're all different, I'm cutting out, I'm gluing, and they're very assemblage, and I'm wondering why am I doing what I'm doing? And then we have a Fuller professor come in, and he's like from the Latin American Central Latino. And he's like, oh, you're doing, you know, you're doing the mestizo, you know, like mixed, you know, cultural mixing. And that's, you know, evident in your artwork. And I'm thinking, oh, man, you just named what I So all that stuff gets worked up in me and it somehow comes out. And so it just takes people, again, a collaboration. I don't, art can't be made in, not, you know, by itself. So I need people to, we need people to help you see what you're doing. So what do you see that I'm doing? You know?
I see?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's just a sense of, like, you were talking a lot about this entering into this new space. And I know we were having a conversation as you were working about the cutting of the paper as a sense of, like, entering in and seeing through, like, a gateway.
Totally.
A lot of your shapes are circular, so I couldn't help but think about that art piece when you're talking about the circular ecology and this bringing back around. Yeah. And so, and then we were talking about the paper itself of being this assemblage of this fragile holiness, literally, right? You made all of these holes.
Very good.
But you don't discard the material that once inhabited the whole, right? It becomes a part in a new way of the final product.
Beautiful.
And so it's a sense of,
that's good. You're spot on.
Okay,
I've been writing proposals because I'm trying to get art residencies, and so I liken what I'm doing with when my kids were young, they did blanket forts, right? You know, it's like, so they would take out everything out of your my linen closet, and they would make hallways, and you know, and I just, they're creating places of security and spaces for themselves. So they're identifying space for themselves, but they share it with their friends because it only happens when kids come over, and they're fragile, but yet they're fragile, these fragile forts. And I just, and so I'm thinking that's what I'm doing, is this sense of placemaking and nesting, but yet to have a sense of place and my own space, and to invite others into it, but that's always just fragile, but yet flexible, you know? So yeah, so good call.
it strikes me about that you're doing that with the art, the forms that you're making.
Mm-hmm.
And you were also doing it with finding the location in the village to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember when you first came in, you were sitting at the lunch table and you were talking about where you were going to have your studio. And someone suggested, well, we can get that when all the staff are here on Monday and they can find you. And you somehow, Brian, helped articulate that you needed it before Monday. And it's like...
My advocate.
But it was interesting because you were creating space there. Something inside you knew you had to find space to let your generative juices come out.
And I think that story is a good metaphor for how art is usually perceived. It's like, we'll deal with it later.
Question for you. You mentioned the coming from a reform background and being taught sort of orthodoxy will lead to orthopraxy, that idea, and that at least you intimated that your experience has been somewhat different, or you moved out of that, or can
I think
you say a little bit
I think
more
it's,
about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's a little bit more flexible. I think we have a liturgical theologian in here, right? Do we? So in liturgical theology, there's this thing called lex orandi, lex credendi. The law of prayer leads to the law of belief or doctrine. So basically, it's like your experience, you have the experience, and then you have to reflect on that experience, and that's where the doctrine comes from. We've taken that, and we've divided it. So what comes first, the chicken or the egg? And these things are meant to be in conjunction. And so sometimes the law, so if you're Reformed, you think the law, the doctrine comes first, and that shapes how we pray. If you're Catholic or higher literature, it's like our experiences come first, and that's how we designate what our doctrines and, you know, rituals are. And so these things are not meant to separate. They go back. As an artist, it goes back and forth. I'm informed. It's a conversation. Yeah. And the way that I was not taught that way. You know, it was like taught, do this, know this so that you can do this. And my life experience does not, that's not how my life goes. You know, I'm a daughter of immigrants. I'm a female and at that time in a conservative denomination. I am an artist. You know, so my experience of the world is not as clear cut as the one that the theologies that, and the doctrines that were inculcated, you know, that were given to me, were not that clear cut. And so learning that is, I learned that as an artist, I learned that the world is much more malleable and fluid. But that's not how it's taught to me. But my experience is that's the way it is. And so I think that it goes both ways. Does that make sense? Or I think they're one thing. I don't think we can separate them.
No, the thing that struck me about that is I grew up in Christian school, like a lot of teaching, a lot of like sort of the blank slate, the empty vessel, like we're gonna pour this into you and and like some of that, like cracking out of that into like, well, what does that look like? You're like going from head to heart or like some of that stuff.
It's all theory.
It just struck me.
Yeah, it's all theory, and the world does not operate that way. I mean, like, okay, so again, conservative church, mainly made up of 30-year-olds in New York City, and so the stance is, you know, no sex before marriage, right? So that's the stance. We're going to teach you the biblical stance on sex, and no sex, you know, and that's it. Know that so that you can not do that, right? And I'm like, whoa, where are the practices? Because who can do that? Who can do that alone? So somewhere, they're not considering the reality of living in the 21st century as a single person in New York City as a 30-year-old. Where are the practices? If that is what you want me to live out from the doctrine or dogma, then please give me the praxis or the heart to shape me so that I can't do that on my own. And so that, I feel a lot of Christianity is that, and that's why we need more embodied practices, or we need to recognize the reality of that wound and be truthful about it, so that we can do the practices. We can, you know, figure it out together collectively. So, and the arts are one way of doing that, or artists give us a clue onto how to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have never thought of that role of art. That's just really, really colorful.
Yes.
Yeah. Very powerful. And you were—it's funny because you were just saying, similar to Cecilia Gonzalez, talking about the beauty possible when we reach out to engage the real in all its wounded fullness, rather than some proclamation about what you're supposed to do.
Right. Yeah.
And that's what I find to your comments, Cynthia. I mean, I think everyone in this room could say amen. It's like, yeah, I sat in church. And where, you know, I couldn't address my pain. Mm-hmm. We're all singing happy songs, mm-hmm. and you're dying. And so, I mean, yes?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, Emily Towns, who's a womanist ethicist, in one of her books, she has a sermon. It's a theological discourse, but she begins with a sermon, and she draws upon the book of Joel and says that communal lament for the people that were utterly destroyed in chaos in early Israel, it was communal lament, crying out to God communally, mm-hmm. that enabled social healing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So is it possible that the arts might be a... We're no good. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I'm going to say we, I'm talking about, say, Northern European rooted...
Let's just talk about humanity.
Lament.
Yeah.
We, you know, at best we recite lament songs, but we should be wailing in the streets communally right now.
Yeah.
I mean, what about if climate change? What if cities wailed in the streets? I just wonder about arts linked to spirituality as a seed ground for communal lament.
Don Saliers, who's a organist and liturgical theologian, writes, and I love this because this is what our liturgies are supposed to be doing. What these guys are doing, our liturgies are supposed to be doing. This is a liturgy is where human pathos, our experiences in the world, come and meet God's ethos. And when those two things come together, I mean, so the reality of who we are, but it hits the divine. And art can help us do that. Art addresses this, and it also helps us with the transcendent, with, you know, the other that we have no words for. Amen?
Yes.
Okay. So go do likewise.